Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. The Huffington Post called today's guest a Renaissance man to whom the late Michael Crichton had passed the baton of a new genre, a unique combination of historical fact, thriller, and science fiction. The Last Odyssey is described as the thinking reader's fiction. And if you haven't already guessed, today I'm joined by number one New York Times bestselling author James Rollins. The Last Odyssey is the 15th in his highly popular international series about Sigma Force. Today we talk about some of the history behind the story and how it inspired The Last Odyssey, and where James traveled, all in the name of research. We'll also separate a little fact from fiction and take a sneak peek at a new book of short fiction coming later this year. Here's my guest, James Rollins, and his book, The Last Odyssey. Well, James Rollins, I'm so glad to have you back on Conversations Live. I think this is the fourth time we've spoken, and I believe this is the 15th book in your best-selling Sigma series. Is that right?
That is exactly correct.
Right. And you put a note at the front of your book for readers who still seek out lost worlds and greater truths within, hidden within scribbles of ink on paper. You invite them and thank them for coming on this journey with you. And boy, what a journey The Last Odyssey is.
I'm going to be leaning on Homer's epic. I figured my story better be epic.
I know. There were a couple of things that I learned from reading your notes. I always love the author notes and the history notes and what's truth versus fiction. The couple of things I learned there that kind of disappointed me, because I loved Homer and the Iliad, but not your fault. It's history. It's history. We'll talk about those in a bit. But let's jump straight into a synopsis of The Last Odyssey and tell us in your own words what the story is about, if you will.
Well, the story starts when a group of researchers stumble upon a shocking find. It's a centuries-old medieval ship that's buried a half mile underneath the ice of Greenland. Researchers go in there. They discover the hold contains a collection of strange artifacts, both wondrous and horrific, dating back to the Bronze Age. And in the captain's quarters, they found a clockwork gold map that was crafted by a group of Muslim inventors that are actually considered to be the Leonardo da Vinci's of their time. Leonardo da Vinci attributes his success to standing on the shoulders of those original Muslim inventors. But the map seems to indicate or seem to hint that it knows the way, the path to Tartarus, the Greek version of hell that's featured in Homer's Iliad and the Odyssey. And in order to stop zealots from breaking those gates open and unleashing an apocalypse, Sigma Force has to go in there and travel to where, you know, humans fear to tread, to cross the very gates of hell in order to save the world.
So, as usual, you've mixed mythology with some science and technology there, but where did this story spark for you? Where did that first idea originate, and how did it evolve for you, James?
Well, for the longest period of time, everybody thought the city of Troy was a mythic place. They thought it was something just of Homer's imagination. And that was believed for centuries, all the way up until the 19th century, when an armchair archaeologist named Heinrich Schliemann, following clues left in Homer's epic poems, sort of figured out where he believed Troy could possibly be located. He went to Turkey, and the coast of Turkey, dug into a hillside and covered some ruins. Decades later, it was proved that those ruins he discovered were indeed the lost city of Troy. So, you know, basically within a second, you know, myth became history. Now, that's been sort of at the back of my mind, and then I learned that there was a British management consultant, another armchair archaeologist, who discovered the mythic city of Ithaca, supposedly the hometown of Odysseus, the hero of the Odyssey. For the longest period of time, people thought, well, maybe it was the island of Ithaca, but this again, being an armchair archaeologist, looking at clues in Homer's books, he ended up finding that, no, that's not the island of Ithaca. It's here on the peninsula of Palike. And the geology that he uncovered matches exactly the description in Homer's Odyssey. It took a little bit of while to get confirmation from historians and archaeologists, but all of a sudden they said, yeah, I think you're right. I think that actually is Odysseus's hometown described in the Odyssey. So basically we had the start of the novel of Homer's Odyssey, Troy being a real place, and now we have the end place, Ithaca being real. So I'm, you know, being a thriller writer, I'm wondering what about everything in between?
Right.
You know, the story of gods and monsters and curses and witches. You know, how much of that, you know, if you strip away the fanciful nature of the storytelling, you know, are there some hidden truths buried in there? Is there some real locales that will match Homer's story? And ultimately, what was he really revealing with those stories?
Right. And this is what I was disappointed in. And again, as it's not your fault, it's history, right? I'd studied the Iliad and the Odyssey at school and Homer, and it turns out that history doesn't necessarily think he was real, after all.
No, I think the consensus now is that Homer is just sort of a pseudonym to cover a wide range of different bards that were telling this story. Different aspects of the story probably cobbled together into this grander epic. But, you know, I always believe that stories that survive the test of time oftentimes have seeds of truth buried in them. The fact that Troy existed, the fact that Ithaca existed. And so my goal with this novel is, you know, I did a lot of research, is to try to shine a light and, you know, try to peel back a lot of the mythology to look for the history that's actually contained in Homer's Iliad and the Odyssey.
Right. Why do you think we're so fascinated by what lies underground? We find this ship like half a mile underneath a glacier, down buried into a glacier. Why do you think we're so fascinated by this kind of stuff?
Well, I think at this point, the unknown, I think it's just a part of human curiosity. You know, we don't like blanks, so we want to fill in blanks. And so, you know, what's buried underground has a certain reverence. There's the old adage, you know, what's buried never stays buried forever.
Right.
It's that, you know, there's belief in an underworld. And that's why when I was doing my research, I found this really fascinating, that across so many cultures, the underworld, you know, the caverns, the version of hell or Hades or Tartarus, it's always underground. It's always buried. And I was curious. I talked to some mythologists and some archaeologists and historians about, you know, why is that so? Why is this, what is this fascination with placing hell or the afterlife or where we go when we die to be underground? And some of the consensus is that, you know, it's the mystery. It's we need to fill that blank. And so we fill that blank of the underworld by creating a mythology of that's where we go when we die.
Right. Because there's so much that we do not know, so much that where we've tried to fill in the blanks and we're just supposing, we're doing our best guess. So there's still so much we don't understand. You say there's true history buried in the myths of the two epic poems. What do you want to say about that?
Well, my goal, like I said, is and it's a theme of all my novels, actually. You'll see this theme quite commonly, is looking for, you know, the truths that are hidden in story. I think story is a great way of revealing truths that maybe we don't really want to face. And so my goal with this story is to expose the, you know, what was Homer trying to tell us about through the Iliad and the Odyssey? And what I discovered from talking to historians is that, you know, Homer's history, where the Homer's story takes place, Iliad and the Odyssey, is in a shadowy period of history known as the Greek Dark Ages. It's a big blank spot in human history. It's basically three centuries from 1100 BC to 800 BC. That very little is known about. There's very little record. Matter of fact, the only written account, really, of that period of time is Homer's epics. That's why the Greek Dark Ages are sometimes called the Homeric Ages, because Homer has really the only account of that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And why so little is known about that period of time is that what we've, you know, looking at artifacts and archaeologists digging deeper, they realize that there was a great war that occurred during that period of time. Prior to 1100 BC, there were three very thriving kingdoms. There was the Mycenaean Greeks, the early Greeks, Babylonian Hittites, and then there was the Egyptians. In a matter of 20 years, those three civilizations were brought to ruin. Some invading force, a force that even to this day we're not quite sure who they were and how they were powerful enough to bring down three civilizations, but they succeeded in doing so. So there was basically a huge Mediterranean-wide war that occurred during the 20 years. And as the fact that at that point, to the people that were living around the Mediterranean, that was to them the known world, many historians are describing that battle, that 20-year battle that brought three civilizations to their knees. They described that as World War Zero, you know, basically the first global war, mm-hmm. the first war of the known world. And that's what Homer was trying to illuminate. You know, the Trojan War is just one battle in that much greater war that was occurring. So, you know, my goal in writing this novel is to look deeper into that dark age, you know, shine a bigger light. I traveled to Greece, to Rome, to Sardinia, the Spanish coast, you know, trying to both map, you know, the possible route that Odysseus took after he left Troy, trying to match locations that might have been where Homer was trying to describe, and then bringing to life that great war that occurred during that Greek Dark Ages, and to reveal what I think is quite fascinating history about that just now is coming to light.
Right. Let's talk about some of those locations you went to, because they sound fascinating. In fact, you say in the book, you recommend we read the book in Iceland.
Exactly. The book starts in Iceland when they actually traveled to Iceland, and I visited the Blue Lagoon Spa, the hot springs there, and so I decided to, you know, to start my characters there where they're bathing in nice warm water before I, you know, throw them into the frozen wilds of Greenland. You know, before I throw them to the adventure, they get a little moment of peace before all hell breaks loose, literally.
Yeah, and then you went to the Helheim Glacier. I've heard about that, but I haven't been to up that way. It's on my list of to-do stuff.
Yeah, if you go, the challenge nowadays is that, you know, Greenland's ice is melting very fast, and that's one of the sort of revelations of the book is how fast the Greenland ice is disappearing. And as that ice is melting, a melt water channel opens up that allows these researchers to discover this buried ship. And I also deal with some of the way the natives live in Greenland and what some of their rituals and their beliefs are of that area in regards to what's happening in Greenland right now.
Mm. What surprised you the most, James, when you were researching that?
Surprised me the most, probably two things. Number one was that, you know, we have a tendency to underestimate the technology of ancient peoples. And when I was in Greece, I went to the National Archaeological Museum in Athens, and they have a device on display called the Antikythera mechanism. If you ever get a chance to look at it, look it online, it looks literally like a piece of machinery or possibly part of a computer. But actually, most archaeologists now accept that the device was probably the first known crude version of an analog computer. And so I dug deeper, and I discovered that there's a whole history of innovation by the ancient Greeks. You know, historians and archaeologists have documented countless designs of these self-operating mechanisms, these automatons, and all these sort of just crazy inventions. And some of that will appear in my novel. So, you know, Last Odyssey is basically a way for me to sort of shine a light. You know, I watched that show, Ancient Astronauts,
right,
where they believe that, you know, gosh, you know, who created the pyramids? You know, how come these ancients were able to do these things? And we have a tendency to dismiss their own ingenuity and intelligence and innovation by saying, oh, no, it's aliens did that. No, you know, it's the creativity of humans that did that.
Yeah. I remember the first time I went to Roman ruins, obviously I'm from Britain, where I went to a place called Cirencester. They had refrigeration, they had central heating, very different to what we have today, but they had it.
Well, one of the quotes I have at the very beginning of the scientific notes at the beginning of the book is, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. You know, when humans are faced with challenges, have another word, chased with a challenge right now, we innovate. We can we innovate our ways out of you know, significantly dire straits to still be around today.
Mm. Did you have a favorite location when you were traveling? It sounds like a very painful trip for you, James. There.
It was horrible. You know, one of the things that I don't, it was my favorite, was the most fascinating, I think I've spent in a long time, is that my Italian publisher invited me out to speak in Rome and in a little town where they're having a literary festival called Velletri, just outside of Rome. And Velletri is literally just a stone's throw away from Castel Gandolfo, which is the Pope's summer palace. And for the longest period of time, no one can go into the Pope's summer palace, but I thought, I'm going to just go by there, because I'd featured the palace in before in a book or two, so I want to take some snapshots. Well, I got there, and the new Pope has opened up Castel Gandolfo for tours. And so I was able to do a tour of the Pope's summer palace, and it was just absolutely fascinating. I'll give you one anecdote from that, is that there is a group of people living in Italy today that are known as the Pope's children.
Hmm.
And why they're called that is that during World War II, the Pope at that time opened up Castel Gandolfo to be a refugee camp, because Castel Gandolfo is considered to be on Vatican property, so if refugees can get onto Vatican property, they're protected against the Nazis. So they had a lot of people fleeing Nazi persecution, were bivouacked in Castel Gandolfo. And the Pope's bedroom became the birth chamber, birthing chamber. So when women were pregnant and giving birth, they gave birth in the Pope's bed. And so any children that were born in the Pope's bed were considered today to be the Pope's children.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
I just find little tidbits like that just fascinating. Yeah. They just sort of stumble upon accidentally.
Yeah. Is there a large group of them?
I haven't mentioned the number in the book, but there's a fair amount. It's like almost like 150 children were born, because they were there for, I think, like 4 or 5 years.
Right. Interesting. I'd never heard that story before. I love those little tidbits. Like I said, one of the favorite parts of any author's books, if they put this together, is when I read the truth versus fiction and the historical notes, etc. Tell me what you changed in your book, where you took creative license and you felt you took the most risk.
Well, I think, you know, at this point, my goal when I was writing this novel is to try to find, or at least create, what could be the true location of Tartarus, the Greek version of hell. And so I leaned a lot upon the history of what that mysterious enemy was that brought those three civilizations to ruin. And then I thought, well, you know, that's a scary civilization. The Egyptians were terrified of whoever this unknown enemy is. They would. There's just only a couple of references to them, because they were scared to bring them up by name. So pretty scary bunch. So I think, you know, if there's hell somewhere in the Mediterranean, it's probably where these people came from. So then I had to find out, and by doing some research, to find out, you know, where did this enemy come from? And the consensus is they came from, I don't want to give too much detail away, because
right,
part of the bill.
Right.
But at that point, looking for the origin of where these people arose from, that's of my pure imagination. And then I took some of the technology that the Greeks were working on, these automatons, these ingenious machines, and extrapolated, you know, if they're left to their own devices for a longer period of time in isolation, what might have they created? And what they created, could have that possibly led to some of the mythology that permeated that area?
Mm, interesting. Interesting. So, I mean, this series for you has been highly successful. This is the 15th book in the series. And I read somewhere that you never, ever wanted to write a series. It was your publisher who pushed.
Yeah, you know, I resisted. All my early novels were standalone novels, and I was getting pressure to do a series. But I didn't really want to do it, mostly because of what I call the Jessica Fletcher syndrome.
Right.
Jessica Fletcher, the murder she wrote.
Right.
Here's this, you know, this woman from Cabot Cove who keeps stumbling over dead bodies, you know, week after week. You know, I've never stumbled over a dead body, so I don't know what her problem is. So, you know, eventually you begin to strain your suspension of disbelief after a while. And also, it's hard to maintain jeopardy with a series character like that, because if, let's say, somebody puts a gun against Jessica Fletcher's head in one episode, you know that trigger's never going to be pulled because Jessica Fletcher's in next week's episode.
Right.
Well, it's hard to maintain that tension. So I didn't want to get into that whole quagmire until I sort of stumbled upon Sigma Force in my novel Sandstorm. They were an ancillary group of characters, but they were a group of characters. And I thought, oh, you know what I can do? I can do a series based on a group of characters. That way the jeopardy can come from many different directions. Nobody's safe because I can knock off a major character in the Sigma group because it can always recruit a new member. So I like the idea that nobody is necessarily safe in this group.
Yeah. Well, that was going to be my next question, is how do you create that tension? And you do have a cast of characters. Do you have a favorite character?
Probably one of my favorite characters actually is one of the point of view characters in this novel. What I also like about having a group is that in various novels I can switch my spotlight onto a different, a few different characters in that group. Because Sigma Force is a sprawling enterprise, and so there's a core group, but I can switch that spotlight around.
Mm-hmm.
And in this book, the spotlight concentrates on one of my favorite characters, Kowalski. You know, Sigma Force are these elite former soldiers that have been retrained in scientific disciplines. They're scientists with guns. They're very keen with what they can do. Whereas Kowalski is not quite the brightest bulb in the bunch there, but he's got secret talent, hidden talents that you know, by being able to bring him to the forefront and make him a point of view character in this novel, you get to know him a lot better. You'll get an idea of the depths to this character that aren't readily apparent from looking at his gruff, brutish exterior.
Right, right. I want to ask you a question about the warped spaces, because first of all, how did they get that name, warped spaces? And
well,
who are they?
They had that name before I got there, but it's basically when I first started to write, you know, I had no formal training in writing, so I joined a writing club in Sacramento, California, and that club had 1,000 members, but they broke up into smaller little groups. Critique groups where those groups would evaluate each other's work, and they usually were defined by genre. Like there's a mystery critique group, there was a critique group that handled biographies, there was ones that handled literary, and this group, the Warp Spacers, dealt with sort of sci-fi fantasy, things out of the norm, and so that appealed to me, so I joined that group, and they were the ones that were critiquing my work before I was ever published. You know, for 4 years I tried to get published, and they wrote a bunch of short stories that are now buried in my backyard, hopefully never see the light of day. but they were the ones that were critiquing and helping me get my work into a publishable, polished format. And they are the same group that critiqued The Last Odyssey. So I've been with this group now for almost 24 years.
Mm. I think a lot of people think when an author becomes successful, or even before then, it's a standalone thing. They don't rely on feedback or anything like that. So it's good to hear that you've been with these guys for so long.
Oh, no, it's like having the 12 of the most brilliant first readers.
Yeah.
You know, they come from different spectrums of life, so I'm getting a bunch of different viewpoints, getting a bunch of different eyes from a wide spectrum of Americana out there. You know, I've got military guys, I've got housewives, I've got doctors, I've got a whole spectrum of different people. So they all bring their something to the table.
Right. Very different points of view. That's great.
And they challenge me. As much as I'd like to go into my critique group and expect them to bow down before me, they don't.
Right. Well, that's good.
they hold my feet to the fire just as much as they did back when I was producing those short stories that are buried in my backyard.
Right. And talking of short stories, I see in September you have a new book coming out, Unrestricted Access, and it's all short stories. So tell us a little about that.
Yeah, it's a compilation of the short, all my short stories that I've written over the last 20 years. So it's going to be quite a thick book.
But not the ones that were buried in the back garden, right?
No, these are ones actually that managed to get published. but I also did new introductions to the stories, so to use them, basically use the stories almost like as a journey through my writer's career. There's introductions that describe, why I wrote the story then, you know, where I got the idea, how it influenced my writing in the future. So it gives you an idea, not just the stories themselves, but also sort of a peek behind the story. But I also didn't want to just sell you, you know, old material, so to speak. Is that I wrote a brand new novella. It's a 100-page story featuring Tucker Wayne and his military war dog, Kane. They originally appeared in Stigma. Eventually I spun them off into their own novels. Now they're appearing in a brand new adventure where you get to see two sides of that dog and handler, the relationship between a military guy and his dog. I write scenes from the Army Ranger's point of view, but I also write scenes from the dog's point of view.
Mm.
You get a better idea of that relationship.
So is that going to be part of the new series I saw you have coming out in 2021?
No, that is I'm branching off into a whole different genre. I'm going to be actually starting a fantasy series.
Wow.
It might sound odd for me to write, but actually when I started my career, I was actually writing a fantasy a year under a different pen name and a Rollins thriller every year. So I'm actually going to sort of go back to the beginning of my career and that for the next few years I'll be writing a fantasy a year and a James Rollins thriller a year.
Wow, you're a busy guy, as always, right?
I've written two books a year for the entirety of my career, so it's
yeah.
For me. As a matter of fact, I made the mistake of trying to do three books a year, 2 years in a row. That almost broke me. That was hard.
Mm. Now, when you're writing short fiction, James, do you approach that differently to when you're writing a full-length novel?
Oh, totally. I mean, to me, short fiction is still really challenging in that... When I remember one class I had in like English, high school English, they were talking about the challenges of writing. And they were saying that, you know, a novelist is the easiest way to write because you have a lot of elbow room, you got a lot of space and pages in which to tell your story and get into sidetracks and subplots. Whereas short stories are harder because you have to accomplish the same thing, tell a story. You have to, you know, introduce this world to your reader. You have to engage your reader with your characters, and then you have to tell a story. But you have to do it, you know, in a lean, mean machine to get it done in X number of pages. And then even harder than that is poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have just a certain number of stanzas in which to get your point across. Then you have to judge each word.
Right.
So to me, yes, story writing a short story is. I think it takes me as long to write a short story as it probably takes me to write a quarter of a novel.
Right. That's interesting. And so I saw that we've been talking largely today about The Last Odyssey, your brand new book, but I saw your book tours being cancelled, obviously,
yes.
Because of what's going on with the coronavirus. Will you be reaching out virtually? Will you be putting together some kind of virtual tour for people?
I did. I actually did a Facebook Live, almost an hour-long little talk about the books. I did it in my office, and I toured people through my office and showed them the artifacts in my office and gave a little glimpse behind you know, who I am as a writer by using my office as a template just to demonstrate that.
Yeah, very cool. Well, it's always such a pleasure talking with you. Your books are always thrilling and interesting because I'm fascinated by the way you weave everything together. I know listeners can find out much more about you at jamesrollins.com. What would you like to leave them with today, James?
At this point, you know, the last thing I did in my little Facebook Live thing was I pulled a copy of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy off my bookshelf, done by Douglas Adams. It's a classic of sci-fi. And in that book, the Hitchhiker's Guide has imprinted upon it very important words if you're actually, you know, hitchhiking through the galaxy. And those two words are don't panic.
Right.
And that is my lesson for today. It's, you know, it's a scary time right now, but everybody take a deep breath. You know, just, you know, keep some distance, wash your hands. We'll get through this together.
That's the key. We'll get through this together. James Rollins, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Vicky. It's been a pleasure here, too.
And you can find out much more about James and his work and his latest book, of course, at jamesrollins.com. You can find us at conversationslive.net. We post a new podcast every Wednesday. You can find out more than 700 podcasts, more than 1,200 guest interviews on conversationslive.net. Thanks for being with us. Until next week, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.